Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 2nd, 2002. Today's session is titled, The Threat of Islam, Myth or Reality? It is presented by Harold and Mai Vogelaar. Its number is VOH 2002-10. Let's listen in.
But our concepts of space and time are quite different, which is kind of nice. So I guess you can start the tape if you want to. I'm Harold Vogelaar, and here with my wife, Pitsamai. There she is. Oh, up there. She's got another view of things. Okay. And this will be on the contemporary scene, trying to get behind some of the headlines into the hard lines. It's the last of a series of five. We began, remember, with Abraham down here. We didn't actually look at the creation stories, but there are interesting creation stories in the Quran. We looked at Abraham and then Muhammad and their faith and practice. And yesterday we saw some of the grandeur and glory that was Islam's in the past with these great empires. And we didn't talk much yesterday about the fact how Islam sort of challenged Christian theology. We looked more at the political, but I sometimes think, just what I'm thinking by myself, that the Hellenistic overlay of the Middle East following Alexander's conquest, and that Christianity then sort of became absorbed into the Hellenistic and the Greco-Roman world, right? And even all of our creeds and so on are sort of fashioned in that language. And that there was no way for the Middle East to sort of throw off that mantle of Hellenism, that mantle of Rome. Nobody was successful in that. Usually you adapted to it and you became caught up in it. And Christianity probably did that. Islam might just be, could be looked at as sort of that Semitic attempt to throw off that Hellenistic, Romanesque kind of overlay on the society. Coming out of the desert, it was definitely Semitic. It hadn't been caught up in the Hellenistic world. And then when it came and conquered, you see, it actually succeeded in sort of restoring that Semitic underlaying. And a footnote here, that what some Muslim scholars are saying now is that the West needs to recapture some of its Semitic roots, its biblical roots. We all say, of course, let's go back to the Bible, right? That's a nice phrase that turns well, and we love it. But actually, I think we wouldn't really like to go back to the Bible, okay? We don't even like the robes that the Arabs wear. We don't like their headgear. We don't like their beards, you know? So many things we don't like about that Semitic culture. But maybe we need to sort of recapture some of that. And the Muslims, on the other hand, need to do more to accommodate to that Greco-Roman world. They toyed with it for a long time. The philosophers, of course, knew it very well. Many of the scientists. But finally, I think, Islam as a body sort of rejected that and clung to their Semitic roots, the Quranic roots. So there has to be kind of a coming together again. And I think we can see signs of that in many different places. That's just sort of one opening comment. But were all of you at the Bible study this morning? Mm-hmm. Our time is rather short, but maybe I could just share with you a story which I think kind of epitomizes for me this saying the right thing about Jesus and then actually taking the teachings of Jesus seriously and doing those. When we were living in Egypt, my former wife was a professor at the university, American University in Cairo. And one day a student of hers invited us to his home in the Delta. And there he had a scroll. It was, you know, rolled up in the corner along with several others. So we said to him, Muhammad, and there are many Muhammads in the Middle East, right? Thousands, millions. Ada, what's this? He said, well, just some doodlings that I made. We said, could we see one? So he took one out, and here was the picture of a young man dressed in his galabiya, and he had his kufiya and his akal, right? And in one hand, he was stretching forth, was a dove. And then in the other hand, high above, barely visible, but visible, was a long sword. So all the images, the stereotypes, right? You can never trust them. You know, they'll use power, they'll use force, and so on and so forth. So I said to him, Muhammad, what does this mean? Well, he said, as good Muslims, we always have to offer peace first. But if peace is rejected, we have to have the sword ready in order to defend ourselves. Wow, sounds rather American. So I said to him, Muhammad, could you draw that picture where he's holding the dove in both hands and no sword? And he thought for a moment and then he said, yes, but in that case, I would have to draw a picture of Jesus, the Son of Mary. Because only he could do that. Do you know why? He said. Because if you or I tried it, before long somebody would steal the dove. Then they would take everything that we have. And finally, he said, they would, you know, he went like this. Right? They would kill us. And we would lose everything here. But, he said, we would gain everything there. And he pointed to heaven. On the other hand, he went on to say, if we held the sword in both hands now, we might gain everything here, but we would lose everything there. So it's better to have the dove in one hand and the sword in the other. That way you get the best of both worlds, right? Now, think of what he was saying. Think of what he was saying. That security is a real issue for the Muslim community. We know about that in our communities. Tremendous appreciation for the person and the teaching of Jesus the Christ. Credible. Only he could do that. At the same time, thirdly, a healthy skepticism, a real distrust whether the teachings of Jesus will actually work in this kind of world. See? Okay? Only Jesus could do that. If you or I tried it, look what would happen to us. Okay? Now, just sort of ponder that a little bit. As Lutherans, we love to sing the way of the cross, right? But that means vulnerability, weakness in the eyes of the world now, and many other things. Is that really what we want? Do we really want to be manna people? You know, the way of the cross? Or are we glad that we have the biggest sword in the world and we can strike anyway, right? We can just lob missiles anywhere. And we'll hold the dove, but our real trust, you know, is in here. Yeah.
It sounds to me like your friend mastered what Jesus called the wisdom of the serpent. And we are encouraged to have the hearts of turtle doves and the wisdom of the serpent. Don't get the two mixed up.
Yeah.
And speaking from personal experience, I've been an attorney for almost 30 years, and the best way to settle a case is to gear up for trial. And you get to know your case, hopefully, and your opponent's case. We don't talk about enemies. And so when your client comes in with still retaining these gossamer ideas of whatever, you say, look, this seems to be the reality.
Yes, right.
And hopefully the other attorney is sitting his or her client down saying, guess what? You know, and that's why most cases settle.
Right.
But I think it's good to have a tub and a sword ready.
Yeah, well, it's very American, I think. Very, very American, absolutely. Now, what Muslims have gone on to say is that if Jesus had had the opportunity to raise a militia and to establish his kingdom here on earth, he would have done so. And they quote all these verses, I've come not to bring peace but the sword, to set father against son and daughter against mother. You know, they have all these verses that they pull out, right? But because the Romans were so powerful, it was impossible for him to do that. And it took the church almost 300 years until Constantine came along, when finally they could get their act together, and then they could do what Jesus, you see, would have done almost immediately if he could have. And where Muhammad was, there were no Romans. So in fact, Muhammad could do almost immediately what Jesus would have done. And then I want to say to them, friends, I don't think you got it right. I think Jesus went the way of the cross, not because the Romans were so powerful or the forces against, you know. This is really God's way of ultimately overcoming evil with goodness. And it doesn't matter, you know, how much power you have in terms of armies and political and so on. This is a different way. My kingdom is in the world, but it's not of the world. And this is really God's way. But when you say that to a Muslim, okay, you can't just say that as a preacher and then live, okay, something very different. Then you get caught up into this struggle. And that's why I, you know, having grown up in Iowa, a very kind of rednecked, loyal, you know, flag-waving. Over the years now, I've really become into the, quote, pacifist or nonviolent mode of thinking, because I couldn't preach one thing to my Muslim friends and then actually, in fact, you know, live something that's very, very different. I had to try to bring my theology and my practice into closer relationship. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It was said during the Ronald Reagan's first administration that fine Christian man, by the other fine Christian man, Jerry Falwell, which is part of his political platform to come to power, and the quote was in the New York Times, and I wish I still had it, that if Jesus were alive today, Jesus would be pushing for more nuclear weaponry.
To be at his disposal. Right.
So that he could come to judge the quick and the dead.
Yeah, right, right.
I mean, that's fairly deep in American.
Right, that's kind of scary.
Fine Christian.
Now, I think, you know, I don't want to stay with this subject, but you see how theologically they always challenge us, they always push us, you know, especially about the Trinity as well. They never let us just get off the hook. You either say what you mean what you say, and we have to sort of clean up our act, I think, just by the words we use and sometimes the hymns that we sing. Our Christology has gotten so huge So we've almost lost our theology and lost our pneumatology. I think we need to put these much more into a proper sort of perspective and understanding them. Well, I just... how do I get onto that track? Anyway, we talked about the grandeur of empire and then how the fortunes of the world kind of shifted from the Islamic world to the Western world. And I don't know how that happened exactly, where we went from quite primitive methods and means suddenly to think that we could conquer the world. But when the West went out, that's what happened. We colonized, we conquered the whole conquest of America, Central America, South America. I mean, you read that. It's a very interesting story there. For about 100 years to 200 years, depending on which country, about 80% of the Muslim world fell under the domination of Western, quote, Christian powers. We were there with armies, with forces. Now, when you look at this, this is the sort of the Muslim world here. Can you see it? Mm-hmm. Now, you can tell it's a Muslim map, right? Because America isn't in the center. You always put yourself in the center of the world, right? Of course. Here, the Muslim world is in the center, and it goes all the way to Indonesia here, and then to West Africa and beyond. About 80% of that fell under Western colonial Christian domination. And by that I mean that we were there with the troops. We were there in power, in force. When we came to Egypt in 73, some of the old-timers still remembered that was the British embassy, here's the British cathedral, and in between were the British troops. Okay? Exactly, on the banks of the Nile. They remembered very, very well. And then finally, during that period, it was a time of great soul-searching, incredible despair. How is it that we who were so great, so mighty, the world was at our feet, people came to us when they wanted knowledge, when they wanted information, and now suddenly we have become the laughing stock of the world. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. And when you read some of their poetry, some of their novels, you get the sense of that lament, almost of the Psalms. Oh Lord, how long will you forget us? Forever? And the question was raised then, have we abandoned God? Has God abandoned us? Why have we fallen so low that now we are under the heel of this Western Christian world? Okay? If you never feel the anguish of that, probably you will never understand where the Muslims are coming from today and what's happening in the Muslim world. You have to understand what went before to sort of understand what's happening today. The anguish of this period of exile, they weren't sent out of their homes like the ancient Hebrews. They weren't shipped off to Babylon. They just didn't exist. You could be in the room, but you weren't noticed. You could be there, but it didn't matter, because the real power, the de jure power, you see, or the de facto power, was in the hands of the colonial rulers. And it was a time of great humiliation, and much could be said about that. When it finally ended, colonialism ended, and fortunes were reversed a little bit, and that didn't happen completely until about, 1962? When was the... Some of you who are older, you remember Algeria? Yeah? Mm-hmm. when you're talking to young folks, that seems like ancient history. And I said, no, that wasn't so long ago. Just 63 or 62. So then finally, they were, as it were, back into their own home. They felt that now they had independence, they had freedom. But what happened, of course, had happened during this colonial period. The First World War, some of you will even remember that history, the whole Ottoman Empire collapsed, right? The whole Ottoman Empire collapsed. And the Middle East was sort of divided by Churchill and Kitchener and others at in Cairo and then at Versailles. So a lot of these boundaries that now make up the Middle East, particularly between, say, Kuwait and Iraq, and then Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and the Mandate, of course, Palestine. These were all carved out by the British. And so this great ummah, this kind of umbrella that had offered a sense of stability and order for at least the Arab Middle East, let me just put it that way, that's what I know the best, somehow was broken. It ended. It collapsed. Now, that's quite a shock to the system. But they had to live with it. So when they came out of colonialism, as it were, they came out as nation states. Nation states has no resonance with the Muslim history. Nationalism actually grew out of the West. It's not indigenous, as it were, to Islam. There, the whole idea was kind of empire and inclusiveness. And the ummah, it's a wonderful word because it comes from motherhood. Yeah, is mother. Ummah, kind of a motherly caring for all the people, all the nations. Some people coming out of this period of humiliation opted sort of to go, I would call here on the left, these would be the secular Western models. And here you have Ataturk in Turkey, right?
Didn't Nasser try to sort of create that in a small sense with the United Arab Republic idea?
Oh, sure. I was going to come to that next. So you get Turkey here on the left, right? And then you get Gamal Abdel Nasser. And then you get Iraq. These are very, very leftist. And what they kind of adopted was a Western form of secularism. And then Nasser was socialism, right? And others of socialism. But these were all imports from the West. Secularism in the West is homegrown. And we have a philosophy to sort of support the idea of secularism, secularity, the secular. It's our plant, as it were. But then it's imported, and now they have adopted it. So it has no real roots, you know, in Islamic thinking, in Islamic history. It's an import. So this kind of wing mirrored then the West, mirrored those who had actually conquered and colonized. And therefore they had the support, in large, of the West as well. We'll talk more about these just a little bit later. But there always were those who wanted, as it were, to reconnect to this glorious past, to relate again to what was. These folks on the left sort of tipped their hat to this. They acknowledged that there was a great past, but they said, that's in the past, we can never go back,
we always have to sort of just press on, and the way the wave of the future, it looks like, is to sort of become Western. Okay? Become Western. As though we are all on the same road and the West seems to be ahead of us and we're behind.
That was that kind of, where Iran was at?
No, 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 no. Hang on. On this side...
Can I ask a question before you go to the... This
yeah, side? Right.
Just to unpack a little bit or elaborate on the what you mean by secular. Because there's a lot of elements to that. Do you mean
right.
democracy? Do you mean something different than that? Can you just describe this imported secularism as you see it?
Secularism is probably where the non-secular would be where God... If I could just draw a kind of... I would say God, okay, humans, or nation here, and then you could say others, okay, nature, etc., like that. I think the pre-secular would be where this is the major drama between God and humanity, okay? That's the major drama. And into that drama, you need to fit other people, you need to fit nature, etc. In secularism now, I'm not talking about secularity necessarily, but secularism as an ism is where this is the real drama, okay? This is the real drama, humans, with other humans and with nature, etc. And God needs to fit into that. And for many people, God isn't relevant to this. Okay? So I think the mentality that was in deeply embedded in the Middle East was that this is the primary drama. And now this has all been kind of shifted. Does that help?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, good. On the right side, where those who really wanted to reconnect, they remembered this great past. They remembered the glory that was the greatness of that early Islam as it burst upon the world scene, and then you know one century went all the way from India to France, and you know all that greatness. How do we reconnect? How do we regain that? And isn't that part of our faith? Okay? It's our faith that is going to sort of restore that. Now, I've written down here, you get a variety of schools on this side. The modernists, the reformists, they really wanted to work at that through education. And they felt that somehow Islam had become defiled, had become polluted, and it needed to be purged. Not reformed. Muslims don't use the word reform, but it needed to be cleansed, brought back, as it were, to its pristine purity. For example, Abdu went to Europe, and then he came back, and he wrote these interesting words in his diary. I went to Europe, and there I saw Islam, but I didn't see Muslims. In Egypt, there are many Muslims, but there's no Islam. Okay? So Islam had become defiled, and it needed to be cleansed. And the way to do that is through education. So Muhammad Abdu and the reformist, the modernist, became very keen on creating schools. But interestingly enough, they focused primarily on higher education. And that legacy still continues. And we lived in Egypt for, 16, 17 years. And my wife was teaching in the schools. And often, you know, the best teachers were put into higher grades, right? So, you know, as though somehow the lower grades didn't need the best teachers. And I don't know exactly why that's so fixed in their minds. But I think in part it developed with Abdu and the reformist movement, sort of, who focused on higher education. Then there were what they call the
And this was more intellectual than political, okay? They didn't necessarily want to restore the political Islam. That wasn't the high, on their agenda. The neo-revivalists, they preferred the ummah to the nation states, and they wanted to revive political Islam and to reconstruct the past and to reestablish Islamic law and to not be against modernity, but against Western culture and Western ideology, secularism. Now, I wouldn't include democracy so much in that. They have their own form of democracy, but it's this kind of God doesn't matter so much, okay, that sort of thing, that idea. In some ways, the moderates, of course, wanted gradual change. This had to be done gradually through a process. But the more radicals became rather anti-Western. They called the West the Jahiliya, and their ideologue was Sayyid Qutb. Now, I always tell students, when these quote foreigners come to study in the United States, you never know who they're going to end up being, right? They might just look like an Indian or Pakistani or, you know, an Asian studying here, but you never know. All right? They might end up to be prime minister. They might end up to be great leaders. So when they're in your midst, please be very courteous, hospitable, engage with them, get to know them, welcome them. Sayyid Qutb is a good example of what happened when that didn't happen, okay? He came here, he was quite dark, he was an Egyptian. This was in the 50s. And he experienced a racism at its fullest. He was often put down, put out, really wasn't received very well. There wasn't a hospitality committee that was functioning well. And when he went back, his experience was so bitter that he began to write about that. And he began to describe the West as the new Jahiliyyah, the new area of ignorance which preceded Islam. Okay, they call the period just before Islam the area, the age of ignorance, Jahiliyyah. Well, this is the new Jahiliyyah, okay? Now, his books are written everywhere. I mean, on every shelf in the Middle East, you'll find something on Sayyid Qutb. He's become the ideologue of these more radical folks. And rebellion and revolution, they believe, are the only way to bring change. Now, for a long time, and maybe I could just give you a footnote here, that for me, in some ways, they represent Ezra and Nehemiah, biblical figures, right? When the ancient Hebrews came back and Ezra and Nehemiah returned with the people, what do they want to do? The first thing is you have to get rid of the foreigners, particularly the women. Okay? So imagine all the heartache that went because every man that was married to a foreign woman had to get with her children, okay? Get rid of her. I mean, imagine. And then you rebuild the walls, and then you rebuild the temple, and then you get back to the law, right? Now, sometimes I think in our Bible studies we celebrate this, but when we hear it from our Muslim friends in the Middle East, what are you trying to do? I mean, this is terrible. And we label it all kinds of, we call it fanaticism, we call it this or that. But it's really the same sort of mentality, I think. How do you sort of recover? How do you restore what was when it's all been more or less destroyed and overlaid and crushed and mangled
during this period of colonialism, of exile. Now, Nasser used this right wing to gain power in the early 50s. And when he came to power, it wasn't very long, and Nasser, who tended to be, you know, very Western-looking, secular, etc., saw that the goals of these Muslim fundamentalists or these Muslim conservatives were not his. And so he imprisoned many of them and was very harsh on them and tortured many of them. So it was a sad state for this religious right here. And that continued up until, what, 1967. Remember what happened in 1967? Israel defeated the Arabs in 5 days, right? And everybody celebrated here. It's like Miriam and Moses celebrating, but on the bottom of the sea were the Egyptians, right? And killed out in the desert, burned out, shot, you know, these were the Egyptians. And I think many in America didn't even know sort of the carnage that was wreaked at that time. Well, when that happened, many on the right now, many of the more conservatives said, why do we, look what happens when we try to follow the West. Look what happens when we import these ideologies and the sociology, these Western ideologies, not communism, but socialism. You know, why don't we try Islam? Why don't we go back to our faith, right? To the things that really matter. And so it was a hue and cry against this kind of mentality. And Sadat came to power, and he capitalized on that again. And he said, you're right. So he started calling himself the Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Prince of Believers. Very Islamic term, right? Battle of 73, he called the Battle of Badr. I forget what Nasser had called it. It was but land, earth, and sky was the battle cry, okay? It had nothing to do with Islam. The 73 war was called the Battle of Badr, where 300 Muslims defeated 1,000 Meccans. Yeah? God was fighting on our side. That's what the Quran says. And the battle cry was Allahu Akbar. God is greater. The ancient battle cry of the Muslims when they went out and captured, you know, conquered so much of the world. So he harnessed all this energy, and we were there at the time. We had just come in 72. All this literature began to flow back. All these people who were imprisoned by Nasser came back on the streets. Beards began to sprout, you know, the headgear, the hijab, and so on and so forth. All of this was going on. And so that harnessed that then in order to sort of bring his great battle where he defeated the Israelis at the Suez Canal. And whatever you may think of the Battle of 73 in the West, when you were living in Egypt, it was life-giving. Because the Israelis, when we were there in 72, they would fly over Cairo, okay, and break the sonic barrier. Boom! And these old windows in these old mosques would, you know, they would shatter and then they would break. And nobody could do anything about it. They were just powerless, it seemed. And so the despair was just, you could cut it with a knife, right? It was so deep. Well, in the 73 war, all that changed. But the Egyptians didn't believe
that things had changed when they heard it on their own news, their own radio. They didn't believe their own radio at all. They didn't believe BBC. They didn't believe Israel. It wasn't until their own soldiers started coming back from the battlefront and telling how they crossed the canal, how they shot down Israeli airplanes and knocked out Israeli tanks and, you know, had captured that whole... it's true. It's true. And so life kind of flowed back into the veins and they began to look up again. The conservatives were very, very happy with this and celebrated it. And they thought, surely now God is going to sort of reverse our fortunes and bring us back. And then Sadat, remember what he did with Kissinger? He made a deal and he opened the door to the West. So all the goods flooded into Egypt from the West and from Japan and from everywhere. All the local produce, the local products, just disappeared. They couldn't compete. They could not compete. So these lovely little bananas that were grown just disappeared, you know. And now we get Chiquita. We get, you know, these big bananas came in. So the West began to flood the whole area. But anyway, the battle was seen as a great boon for the religious right. And then the Shah of Iran was overthrown. And this seemed like another miracle, that maybe, again, God was sort of changing the fortunes of the people. And something new was going to happen. So there was really a lot of energy on the right wing here. When you reconnect with religion again, look what you can do. You can overthrow the Shah, who was backed by the United States with all of our forces, right? And they did it almost in a bloodless way. Very, very interesting. You see, if you just go back to your roots, if you go back to your faith, imagine what you can accomplish. There was the heady stuff there, and I hope that as Christians anyway, you can at least begin to understand and maybe sympathize a little with the power of that, okay, the feeling of that. Now, the U.S. backing this sort of leftist side, this more Western side, the forces against the right, especially after the Iranian Revolution, were really building up. And I want to read you a quote here.
Well, one yeah. question. Sadat was perceived to be quite a friend of the United States and the West.
Oh, yeah.
And yet he's on the religious right.
Right.
And but you're saying that the United States was more inclining towards the left.
Sure, but what does Sadat do after he before the 73 war, he was not the friend of the West, okay? Not at all. In fact, it was the Soviets who were there. He threw out the Soviets, and the United States didn't know what was going to happen. They were not Sadat's friend. It wasn't until after the war of 73, and Sadat opened the door with Kissinger, right? And then all this, you know, began to flood in, that then Sadat became a very Western kind of figure. You could almost say he moved over or you know, to this side, okay? Of course. And then he became a friend of the West. Now, I said that there was this kind of fear, this energy now flowing from the West against this religious right, particularly after the Iranian Revolution and the hostages. Now, I want to quote from Graham Fuller. He was a special agent with the CIA during the 80s, and he was testifying before Congress in 1991, just after the Gulf War, right? And this is a quote. I have to get some light. There was a genuine visceral fear of Islam in Washington as the force that was utterly alien to American thinking, and that really scared us. Senior people at the Pentagon and elsewhere were much more concerned about Islam than communism. It was an almost obsessive fear, leading to a mentality on our part that you should use any stick to beat a dog to stop the advance of Islamic fundamentalism. End of quote. Did you get that? Maybe you read that. Do you remember reading that in the Times? No? Okay. Well, who was the dog at the time? The dog, during the 80s, was Iran, right? And the stick on this side was Iraq. So you use any stick to beat the dog of Islamic fundamentalism. So you arm and you train and you encourage Iraq in its war against Iran because you're afraid of Islamic fundamentalism. Now, hold that on one side of your brain. On the other side, what was going on in Afghanistan? Okay? Yes, right. The Soviets invaded, right, in 79. They invaded Afghanistan. And so during the 80s now, while on the one hand we were supporting Iraq against the Islamic fundamentalists, we were actually recruiting Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan to fight against the evil empire, the Soviet Union. Yeah? So we didn't actually recruit bin Laden, but we trained him. And many others were actually recruited from Algeria, from Tunisia, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, come to Afghanistan and fight the evil empire, and even to use the word mujahideen. Before they were just called rebels. But at that time, the terminology sort of shifted, and the U.S. certainly agreed with that. Call yourself mujahideen, in other words, fighters for God. Because now you're fighting against the evil empire. You see what was happening? Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen the video. I think Ronald Reagan invited them into the Oval Office, if I recall. In fact,
the RC, yes. And who was it that...
They called them freedom fighters.
No, he even went further than that. He called them, he likened them to the founding fathers of the United States. can you imagine, okay? I mean, this is on your other side of the brain, right? Okay. So here we were sort of looking at these bearded fellows now, and these turbans, who were very hard on their women then as well, okay? That didn't just happen just after that. But now they were our allies, fighting against the Soviet Union. Okay? So, when that was over, when the Soviets were driven out, then we just sort of abandoned the Afghanis. They had served our purpose. We said thank you, and we basically abandoned them. And then these warlords came into power. Many of the Arabs that were recruited went back to their homes. They went to Algeria, they went to Tunisia, Egypt, Saudi, even bin Laden went back. So they were not welcome there. Thank you. You've been trained to be terrorists, you know. You've been trained to be warriors. You're not welcome. And so they were actually sent out again. And because we had abandoned Afghanistan, they went back to Afghanistan. And there the Al-Qaeda sort of had its genesis. Yeah.
I think another piece of this that is helpful, and you can help me remember the name, but the U.S. foreign policy after World War II was based on a policy called containment, which meant we needed to have bases around the Soviet Union so that we would have first strike capability.
Right, right.
We went to various Arab nations, and they would not give us those bases.
Right.
And in Iran, the president, who had been elected by the people of Iran...
In 53.
Yes,
right.
What's his name?
Mossadegh, yeah. Mossadegh, yeah.
Would not allow the United States.
He was overthrown.
He was overthrown.
And who did?
By the CIA.
By the CIA.
Yes, right.
Now, I mean,
and the Shah was put in.
This, you know, America's going to get this. I mean, we overthrew a duly elected, democratically elected president who disagreed with us.
Of course.
You know, guess who we put in his place?
Right.
The Shah, who starts killing his own people.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's crazy making.
when you talk this way to an African American audience, they say, "So what else is new?"
Right.
So what else is new? I mean, politicians have been doing this all the time, playing one against the other, etc. But I just want you to sort of get the understanding of what's been happening there, and why some of this policy, it's policy stupid. It's not the U.S. people. It's not you that the Arabs or the Muslims hate. Okay? Where do I have this picture here? You see this guy? All right. Look at this. You remember this one that came out in the Atlantic? The roots of Muslim rage. It's not you.
Then why are they dancing in the streets after 9/11?
Very few dance in the streets. I'm sorry that the media always picks on these kind of incidents, but the vast majority did not dance in the street. Okay, it's not an accurate picture at all.
But it helps with the propaganda war.
It helps with the propaganda war. But having lived there 26 years, I can honestly say that through several revolutions. To the 73 war, when we were there, people always said to us, "Siyasi to siyasi, washab to washab, politics to politics, but people to people." They really actually admire you. I think they really want to be your. They feel that. Many have said to me, "If you really knew." That's our power, right? Now, if we were poor Afghanis or something, you know, the next thing would boom, okay? Okay, we're safe. The building hasn't collapsed. I think they want to be friends with. It's our policies that many of them are very angry about. And then in the case of bin Laden, I think, you know, has spilled over into hatred. Okay. And then you have to ask yourself, how did that happen? When did that happen? I think this is what happened with bin Laden up there. He was our ally. We likened him to the founding fathers of the United States, which is just outrageous. But then something happened, you see, that transformed his anger then finally into hatred. I think these are the questions we need to ask. Not just why do they hate us, but what have we done that could generate such hate? Friends, seriously, I wish I... When we went to the Middle East in 1763... There was such a reservoir of goodwill for America. Yeah, you could just wherever you went, you could just feel it. But over the years, those 26 years, we just felt that reservoir being drained and drained and drained and drained. And we tried to go home and we tried to tell people, we tried to say something to people, but I don't know. We just didn't get it. You know, we just didn't get it. And we could say, if you don't get it, that level of discontent is just rising. And these are mostly young people now, okay? Young people. If you don't get it, there's going to be a price to pay. There's going to be an explosion, okay? None of us knew quite what that would take or how that would develop or look like, but we could just sense it. You could sense it when you were there. And we just didn't. No. I think that the vast majority, I would say, the vast majority, they would agree with the grievances of bin Laden. Okay? And have you read any of his works? Have you read any of his? Good, okay.
Statement, yeah.
You see, but not just
against Christians and Jews.
That's just one of his papers, okay? You have to read the whole, and even if you read the whole document there, what are the grievances that he has? First of all, it's the
I've got it up in my room.
That's good. I read it several times. The Palestinian issue, okay? Some people, well, he's just playing on that, you know. But the Palestinian issue, the Iraqi issue, so many young people have died because of the sanctions, and that's documented by the UN and others. We have wonderful organizations here. We can tell you about that. The fact that troops remained in Saudi Arabia after the Gulf War.
Desecration of holy
places. And then the fact that the West always props up regimes that serve our interests because of, as one president says, our oil in the Middle East. And therefore we are not really concerned about the people. We are not concerned about the common good. About full participation, democracy, and all these things that we cherish in our country. And those are the grievances. I think that many people they resonate with those grievances, okay? But they would disagree with the tactics that he would say. And one of those is, kill any American, man, woman, or child, anywhere you find. I'm sorry, that is not the mind of the vast majority of people, okay? Or to do what they did on September 11th. I think many of them were appalled at what happened, but they understand the grievances behind it. Now, how you separate that out, where that anger doesn't flow over into hatred. And bin Laden, it seems to me, if I read him right, and I would still maintain that this is not a war of ideas. This is not even a conversation of ideas. This is a war where you dehumanize, you demonize, and then you bomb. That I lost my train of thought. You ever have those senior moments?
Talking about bin Laden, if you understand bin Laden right.
Yeah. Yeah, that bin Laden, yeah, right. He has become so hateful of the West that he can no longer see any goodness in the West. Okay? And I think that's so unfortunate. So unfortunate, where blindness really disables you from seeing anything good. At the same time, I think he has so romanticized the past, okay, that he has lost any critical facility. He somehow thinks that if you could just regain this past, go back to what was, that grandeur, that glory, that somehow that's all that matters, and that God then would be on your side and bless you. He's lost a critical facility. And that critical facility enables you not just to glorify history, but to study history and to learn from history. This wasn't all so rosy. This wasn't all so good. It wasn't, you know, but when you romanticize it, and you get emotional, you know, highs from glorifying it, I think it really, it doesn't do anybody any. There's no vision. Yeah, Gary.
Isn't Hussein kind of in the same category that him and Arab?
Saddam Hussein in Iraq is from the Ba'ath Party. Now, I don't know if you know the Ba'ath Party, but He's an awful fellow, so nobody's loving Saddam Hussein, least of all the Iraqi people. But he inherited the Ba'ath Party, which was put together by Christians and Muslims, interestingly, in Syria years ago, because it's based on a secular basis, not on religion, you see. The Christians felt if they based it on religion, they would be the losers. Because it's overwhelmingly Muslim, and they based a party that would be based on Arab history, Arab culture, the Arabic language, etc., but not on religion. And that party then has been hijacked in Syria by Assad, and then in Iraq by Saddam Hussein, unfortunately. Yeah.
I think an important piece to remember in that discussion you just shared about fundamentalism is that is, Martin Marty argues, that is the common thread of fundamentalism in the world, of every religion system. I mean, you look at the Christian fundamentalism in the United States, they have a romanticized version of what was in the past, too.
Yeah, right.
And they have people like Newt Gingrich that rewrites history to make it look like it was a good past. But that is a common tool used by fundamentalists to engage people so that they will support their position and their view and their goal of what they are after. It's a common ploy. It's sick and twisted in my opinion.
But it means that people like bin Laden really have no future. They have no vision for the future. On hatred and a romanticizing of the past, I think the future then becomes almost impossible. Yeah.
One thing that disturbs me is that the most viable criticisms of the United States or Israel come from within the United States and Israel. If you ever read Israeli dailies or something like that, like an editor, whatever, I mean, they're okay, I've said about that. I don't hear anything coming from within the Arab world, either the Muslims or the Christians. And what is even more disturbing is that report on Arab society that was sponsored by the U.S., that in 1 year, only 300 publications are translated into Arabic?
Right.
I mean,
but no, that's an important step, isn't it?
And also that the idea of culture is just to pass on what was. There's no filter to analyze that. I mean, we could turn on the television, and like, you know, that program you showed last night, and here's this critique of the Crusades. I mean, if you got the usual story in school, turn on public television or cable television, hear some people talking about it in a different way. Or you come go to Holden Village or Brady Economist or something. I think what really bothers me is there's nothing like that.
But I wouldn't say nothing, okay?
There doesn't seem to be.
But there is. I mean,
there
when
just
I was
be penetrated.
When I was in Egypt, I sat in many offices with the intellectuals, with the educated. They said there's a silent Islam. But at the moment, we're being silent. We're really being silent, intimidated. And if you dare to speak up, if you dare to be critical, these right-wing groups will just, they will put you on the hit list, and they will kill you. So we have to just be quiet for a while. We're going through an awful period of history, as far as we're concerned. But give us time. And this one article, if you have Steve Niva, I passed it out, the Zayadeen Sardar, very critical. And there are many others within the Arab world and Muslim world who are becoming very, very critical of this kind of policy. So I think it's coming. It's coming. But it has to be slow. Yeah, one more. And then
One thing from my week here is I believe the United States, we have made a strategic error by stationing our troops in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And after 9/11, we're not going to withdraw them because it would make us look weak if we withdrew them after that fact. But I think we have made a strategic error by keeping those troops in Saudi Arabia.
Now, just one quick other comment. That in the Gulf War, we broke the stick that we used to beat the dog, right? we literally broke the stick, yeah?
Without disagreeing with Larry.
Yeah.
I guess there's a perception among Americans that if there hadn't been a Gulf War, that Iraq would have just rolled right through Kuwait and taken over Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea if that's true or not, but if it is true, then is that why we have those troops in Saudi Arabia? And I think there's a perception among Americans that that there's no gratitude from the Saudis for us having protected them from all this, if it really was a threat.
Right.
No, I don't know whether or not. No. Maybe you do.
Right. No, I think these are all issues that all float around, and you can latch on to many of these arguments, you know. And you can come up on a variety of sides in this whole thing. But generally, I would say that we need to pay much more attention to the concerns of the people in the area. We knew Saddam was a bastard long ago, okay? We knew that when he was gassing the Kurds. We knew he was doing that, absolutely. But we didn't say anything about it because he was then fighting our battle against Iran, okay?
He's our bastard.
He's our bastard. Thank you. He's our bastard. We knew that, okay? So, I mean, you know, when you get behind the scenes, can you understand then why that there's this simmering, you know, against the United States? And now with Israel, we won't even go into that. But you have to go. But can I just read one quote from... You've got the Professor C. Niven. The last article is by Martin Marty, right? Mm-hmm. Let me just read into it with one quote here. He said, "Since September 11, I have valued a line from theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, written exactly a half century ago as America entered the Cold War." Somebody mentioned that. And this is the quote. "That it was the paradise of domestic security suspended in a hell of international insecurity." End of quote. On that September morning, September 11th, the cord of suspension was cut. We Americans were dropped into that sphere of global insecurity. Thus we have joined the human race. I think...
Thank you, Martin.
Yes, thank you, Marty. And then he talked... Well, anyway, read the article. It's very, very good. Thank you so much.
You've
been a long trip. It will go on. It hasn't ended.